Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is episode 85 of Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. What do you need to know in the Commonwealth of Virginia to better strengthen and serve your communities as a law enforcement officer? And we're talking about today pat-downs, which is a constant topic. It seems like we're always talking about this. We're always coming back to this. But the courts are sending us new cases all the time, and today is no different. Today we're going to talk about three really interesting cases from the Court of Appeals, from the Fourth Circuit, just from the last couple of months, addressing officer pat-downs. Two cases where the courts have suppressed the results of a pat-down where officers found a firearm, and one case where the officer did, in the view of the court, lawfully find a firearm on an individual. Why are these cases different? Why did the evidence get suppressed? I think you're going to find that there's a lot of lessons in these cases, which are, of course, you know, oftentimes these cases are frustrating because officers are correctly determining, hey, this guy's dangerous, this guy has a gun. You're going to see that in these cases. These officers obviously have the right instincts. These are armed people they're dealing with. They're retrieving the firearms. They're doing so in an effective way. But the court is saying it's not lawful. And why? Why is it that in the two cases it's suppressed and in the one case it's admitted? Well, I want to talk a lot about the facts, and I think at the end there'll be some lessons for you in these cases. So let's dive right into it with a Virginia case from December 29th of last year, and it is a case from the city of Richmond. You're going to see a bunch of these cases, another case later on from the Fourth Circuit, the U.S. versus Peters case, is also from the city of Richmond. So in Hendrick, this is a case where the defendant has drugs for sale. He's got heroin, cocaine, fentanyl. And the way that officers find him is that he is driving in a high crime area, high crime part of the city of Richmond, and officers stop him for a traffic infraction. They don't know ahead of time that he's a drug dealer or anything like that. They just stop him for a traffic infraction. But when they stop him, they can see that he's hunched over and leaning towards the steering wheel, going towards the floorboard of his vehicle, and then he looks back in the mirror at the officers. And immediately, one of the officers says, it looks like he's trying to conceal something. He's concerned it was a weapon. Now, we're going to come back to that a lot, because that single furtive gesture, that single movement like he's going to conceal something, like he's reaching down towards the floorboard, is going to become the basis, the sole basis, pretty much, for the pat-down in this case until later on. So the officer walks up, immediately tells the defendant, get out of the car, do you have any weapons on you? He says, no. He puts the guy in handcuffs. He says, again, do you have any weapons on you? No. And he pats him down and finds no firearms on him, nothing, no weapons or anything like that. So at that point, the officers turn around and they start to do a protective sweep of the vehicle. In other words, a pat down of the vehicle. And we've talked about before under Michigan versus Long, if you have reasonable suspicion to believe that there's a firearm in a vehicle during a traffic stop, under normal circumstances, you're going to be able to pat that area, that grab space, that reaching area around that driver, pat that area down. And they ask him, why were you reaching around in this vehicle? He says, I was fixing my boot, whatever. They don't find any weapons. Now, at that point, though, they ask him, he tells the officers that he had just come home from a gun charge. Well, now, at that point, the officers say, well, now we really do think he's got a firearm in this vehicle. So the other officer joins in on the protective sweep, and both of them start to look around inside the passenger compartment looking for a firearm, ostensibly. But this interaction between the two officers is captured on body cam. And the officers talking back and forth have this conversation where one of the officers says, dude, he was diving in the front, so I don't know if he shoved some stuff down his pants. He definitely was in the front. He had something down his pants, I think. If I was a betting man, he put it down his, sort of in his groin, basically, he says. While they are continuing to pat down the vehicle, they call in the guys with information, and they get a radio dispatch that, according to their check of the defendant was probably armed. Right after they get this information, one of the officers yells out to the other, oh, there you go. There's all the drugs right there. They found him in a little gap under the steering column where they could see a knotted baggie sticking out. While they're doing their pat down, they pull it out. It's got heroin. It's got fentanyl. the gap where they found it was small, but one of the officers did testify that it was sufficient to accommodate a knife or a small Glock or a Derringer. So the trial court in this case rules that the pat-down is unlawful, that the officers lacked reasonable articulable suspicion to conduct a protective sweep, and they rejected the argument that the officers would have found the firearm anyway once they learned about the gun charge and learned that he was probably armed. So the case goes to the Court of Appeals, where the Commonwealth appeals and says, this is clearly, you know, in the eyes of the Commonwealth, a lawful pat-down. We've got somebody who's making furtive gestures in a high-crime area. He's just come home from a gun charge, and they get this radio dispatch that says he's probably armed, right? So how is this not a lawful pat-down? And you might be thinking, obviously, this is a lawful pat-down. Well, let's break it down for a second, because that's what the Court of Appeals is going to do here. The court here starts out with the fact that he's in a high crime area, and the court says, absolutely, that's true, but that can't be enough for a pat-down, right? Because everybody who lives in a high crime area is going to get patted down all the time, and that can't be what the rule is, right? So the court says, obviously, that's a factor, but it's a very limited factor. It gives you very little information. What's important here to the officers, and what we spent a lot of time arguing about, is that furtive gesture I mentioned at the beginning, where he reaches down beneath the seat. And here, the court thinks it's very important that this is the only indication at that point, up until the thing about the gun charge, that he's got any gun, that he's got any firearm on him, that he's armed. And the court says that single movement over the steering wheel and towards the floorboard with nothing else, and he's not moving at all before or after, he ceases the movement immediately, he's got no signs of nervousness, he doesn't have shaking hands, he doesn't have heavy breathing, that single movement is not enough to justify a pat-down of the defendant and a protective sweep of the vehicle. Just that one single furtive movement. And as it turns out, this is something that the courts have kind of struggled with for a while, is what do you do in a situation where you have a traffic stop for a normal traffic violation? Let's say it is in a high crime area and you have one single furtive movement, reaching under the seat or something like that. Does that justify a pat-down? And here the court says, well, let's look at some of the previous cases. You know, there's a case called Curley versus Commonwealth from 2018 where the defendant was, his hands were shaking and he had heavy breathing. Warren Walker versus Commonwealth, where the defendant was breathing heavily and very nervous. Or Glover versus Commonwealth, where the defendant was sweating heavily and appeared nervous and preoccupied. Here we don't have those facts. He's polite. He answers the questions. He doesn't appear to be nervous. He's answering the officer's inquiries, and the sole reason for the stop is basically failure to make a left to fully stop at a stop sign when making a turn. So here the court says that's not enough to justify a pat-down in this case when basically the sole reason is that single furtive movement. And here, in a footnote, the court spends a little bit of time talking about this idea that could there ever be one single furtive movement that would justify a pat-down if the stop were in a high-crime area? And the court doesn't really answer that question. Here, they say all that you have is, you know, the one reach. He kind of leans over and reaches under the seat. That alone, the court says, isn't enough. There are other cases that where officers, you know, come up on a vehicle in a high-crime area. The guy looks at the officers and then, looking at them, reaches underneath the seat and the officers draw down on him and order him to get out of the car and pat him down. And in that case, the court had basically said that was lawful for a pat down. The circumstances of that case were a little bit different, and we can talk about that in another episode. But here the court says this single furtive movement wasn't enough. Now, where does that take us then as far as the defendant then saying, I came home on a gun charge, and then this radio message, oh, he may be armed. Well, at that point, doesn't that justify a pat down? I mean, he said he's just come back from a gun charge, and the radio dispatch says he's probably armed. So how is that not a justifiable pat down? Well, the court here says, actually, that would be enough for a pat down. And we would be okay. We're going to assume here that that is enough for a lawful pat down. But here's where the officer's body camera conversation comes in. Because the court here says officers conducting a protective sweep who have a lawful reason to do so, have to limit the sweep to search for weapons that might contain immediate control, the suspect might gain immediate control over. And so here, according to what the officers themselves are saying, the court says, the officers didn't confine themselves to a limited permissible sweep for weapons. Instead, they were looking for drugs, right? What did they say? They patted him down. They didn't feel any weapons. But they say, I think he had it. I think he had it in his pants. What are they talking about? They're talking about drugs. He was diving in the front, so I thought he shoved some stuff down his pants. It's definitely in the front. When they find it, they say, oh, yeah, there it is. There's the drugs, right? That's what we've been looking for. In other words, in context, their statements are revealing that they're looking for drugs, not weapons. And once they locate the drugs, what do? Right? They find the drugs. Oh, here are the drugs. They stop looking, right? They stop searching inside the vehicle. And so to the court, they says from the beginning to the end, when they were in that vehicle, they weren't looking for weapons. They were looking for narcotics because of their conversation and because as soon as they find the drugs, they stop looking. And so even if they had reasonable suspicion for a pat down, a protective sweep of that vehicle, the grab space around that vehicle, the court says that's not what this was. This was a search for drugs. And that focus on the body camera, on what's captured in the body camera, becomes even more pronounced in the next case we're going to talk about, which is U.S. versus Peters. This is a case from February 24th in the Fourth Circuit, and this is another case where the court suppresses the results of a pat-down. This is a case where Peters is a convicted felon, he's carrying a firearm, and he's walking on public housing property in a high-crime area. And I want to point out, as we go into this, what the high crime area is, because it is an area called Creighton Court. And for Judge Gregory in this case, who writes the opinion, and Judge Floyd, and many of the judges in the Fourth Circuit, you know, Creighton Court comes up a lot. And a lot of motions, there's been several motions to suppress granted out of Creighton Court in the last few years, including a case that we talked a lot about, we have talked a lot about in this podcast, U.S. versus Curry. That's the active shooter case where there's a guy actively shooting off rounds and people are running away, they're fleeing away, officers are responding, and they are trying to, you know, see people's waistbands, show me your waistband, show me your waistband, and they stop Mr. Curry, and he doesn't show his waistband, so they restrain him, and they find he's got a gun on him. That's that case that split the Fourth Circuit by one vote, and they said that that was not a lawful pat-down. It was really important to the court that that was in Creighton Court. They found that, you know, was an instance of racial policing, of over-policing by law enforcement. They really didn't like the tactics that were being used, and they especially found the pat-down to be completely unjustified. So here in Peters, this is the same neighborhood. And I want you to think about Curry and the way they looked at the officer's conduct in Curry when you consider how they look at the officer's conduct here. In this case, they see Mr. Peters, and they know Mr. Peters already because an informant has told them a month before that Mr. Peters was selling drugs from a location basically right in front of where he was walking. A police database listed Mr. Peters as a gang member as of 2011, a narcotics seller or user as of 2009, and probably armed, but again, that was from 2009. Now, this case takes place in 2019, so it's almost 10 years after that information comes out, but the informant's information is about a month old. So they see the defendant, and they see another guy, and they're walking down the walking down a walkway in Creighton Court. Now, the law enforcement officers in Creighton Court have the authority to enforce trespassing rules for the Richmond Redevelopment Housing Authority, RHA. So when they see him, they believe, or they express the belief, that both Peters, the defendant, and this other guy are trespassing. In fact, one of the other officers recognizes Peters' companion as somebody who has been prohibited from being there. Specifically, they know he's not allowed on the property. So they stop them both, and they say, hey, look, both of you guys, you're not supposed to be here. Do you have any weapons on you? Lift up your shirts. So Garrison, the guy that they know is not supposed to be there, they know he's banned from the property, he lifts his shirts. He lifts up his shirt. They see that he's got no weapons, and they let Garrison go. Now, I'm going to pause here for a second. That's very important to the court, because the reason why the officers stop Peters, they explain one of the main reasons they stop him is for on suspicion of trespassing. They get this information from the informant that Peters is selling drugs, and you can make the argument that they had reasonable suspicion to stop Peters for selling drugs. But the officers don't make that argument in this case. They don't say the reason we were stopping him was based on the informant's tip that he's selling drugs. And to the court, that's important. To the court, it's important that the justification they give is they stop Peters because he's trespassing, but they also stop his buddy because he's trespassing, and they let his buddy go once he lifts up his shirt and reveals he doesn't have any weapons. They ask Peters to lift his shirt up, and he refuses to do so. They say, you know, hey, come on, do you mind if we pat you down? He says, I don't want you to pat me down. What are you going to pat me down? So you want me to take you to jail? And the officer and Peter says, for what? And the officer says, for trespassing. Why don't you just let me pat you down, and then I don't have to arrest you and take you to jail for trespassing. They go back and forth. You want me to take you to jail? No, I just want you to, I want to see your waistband, lift your shirt. He won't lift his shirt, blah, blah, blah. This goes back and forth and back and forth many times until finally, after about a dozen exchanges back and forth, he lifts his shirt up a little bit and they can see that he's got a firearm and they secure him and seize the firearm. And again, he's a convicted felon. So the case goes to the district court, denies the motion to suppress. The trial court in this case says the motion to suppress shouldn't be granted and refuses to suppress the evidence. They appeal the case to the Fourth Circuit. Now, the trial court makes a lot of findings of fact in this case. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals pretty much throws all those findings of fact out. And that's a little unusual. Usually a Court of Appeals doesn't do that. But just like in the last case, this exchange is caught on body camera. And so one thing that we're seeing a lot with recent cases is that appeals courts are watching these body cameras and making their own findings of fact. In the old day, when you didn't have body camera and recorded interactions, you kind of had to let the trial court figure out what the facts were, make a finding, and then trust the trial court's findings. We're not seeing that as much, especially when these cases are getting reversed. We're seeing a lot of, especially in the Fourth Circuit, them watching the body camera themselves and saying, well, this is what we're seeing happen, and we're going to make our own findings. And, you know, it's interesting. Is it that good? Is that bad? Does that help you? Does that hurt you? Obviously, at the trial court level, you know, body camera doesn't capture everything, and you're really going to have to work hard to articulate things on the record when there's things that the body camera doesn't capture. Here, the Fourth Circuit watches this camera and rules that the officers lacked reasonable and articulable suspicion to seize the defendant in the first place, and then that they didn't have the authority, lawful authority, to order him to lift up his shirt. So, you know, again, how can that be in this case when you have all of these different factual findings, all these facts? Well, you know, what about the records in the police databases? What about his criminal history? Well, the court says that's all 10 years old. There's no effort to update that, to corroborate that. The information is too old here to act on. What about the informant's tip? Well, the court says they didn't do anything to corroborate the information. The information was provided a month ago, but did he successfully work with the police in the past? Did they corroborate details that he provided? Did he provide information that had led to arrests? Well, yeah, actually, they did indicate that he had provided information that had led to arrests and convictions. But the court here said, well, he's got several pending felony convictions. He's got a federal pending felony drug charge. He's not working with the police at the time. He's in front of the building where he reportedly was supposed to be selling drugs, but he was just sort of walking down the street. He wasn't entering the building, leaving the building. They just sort of got him when he was walking past the building. Now, again, it kind of sounds like they're nitpicking here. And Judge Traxler, this is a 2-1 ruling. So there's only three judges deciding this case. Judge Gregory, who's the chief judge, and Judge Floyd, who's a retired judge. And then Judge Traxler, who's also a retired judge, is the third judge. And he dissents. He says, you know, the court here is ignoring the factual findings of the district court. It's not doing what an appellate court is supposed to do, which is defer to those findings. It's making its own findings of facts and declaring those facts to be insufficient by throwing out the facts it doesn't want to hear. And that's not generally what an appellate court is supposed to do. Certainly Judge Traxler expresses that. But the two judges here feel that this is important and that the court, the trial court, got it wrong. So they, in this case, find, you know, yeah, we have all these facts, but Again, look at what the officers articulate on the scene. They say we were not stopping him for drug distribution or suspicion of drug distribution. We're stopping him for trespassing. And then the court says, but if he's being stopped for trespassing, why did you let his buddy go after his buddy just lifted his shirt? Clearly, that can't be the reason why you really stopped him. You couldn't have had enough reason to stop him for that. It's important to note here on this property, just because you're on the property doesn't mean you're trespassing. Non-residents at this property are not necessarily trespassers, and the fact that you don't live on the property doesn't mean that you're not allowed on the property. Here, Peter said he was visiting his family, and so there you go. But it's interesting, the court itself cites Curry, that case I talked about before with the active shooter, and says, basically, again, implies that the officers here are, over-policing and assuming that anyone on the property is engaging in criminal activity, and that's not a sufficient reason to stop somebody. So, again, it's frustrating two rulings. Do we have an instance where the court's going to find that the pat-down was lawful from the Fourth Circuit? And yeah, actually, as it turns out, we do from January 4th, a case called U.S. versus Blount. And this is, a good example of good articulation by an officer. How do you successfully articulate a reasonable suspicion for a pat-down, especially when you don't necessarily see a weapon? So the way this case comes about is an officer is just sitting in a vehicle in a Target parking lot, minding his business, and someone runs up to the vehicle and knocks on the window of his car and says, hey, there's a disturbance, a possible fight in the parking lot. You need to go check it out. The officer gets out of his vehicle. He can hear a woman screaming in the middle of the parking lot. He can't make out words, but it sounds like a distressed scream. It's very loud. It sounds like she's in trouble, like she needs help. So the officer immediately runs towards the sound. He calls for backup, and he finds a vehicle parked in a parking lot where there's a woman sitting in the driver's seat, and there's Mr. Blount, the defendant in this case, sitting in the passenger seat, and he's got a 2-year-old child in his lap. When the officer walks up, he talks to the people in the car and says, hey, are you guys okay? And so, yeah, we just had an argument. And they give some phony baloney explanation for it. But the officer says to the guy, hey, man, step out of the car for me, if you would, for a second, and leave the vehicle in the car. Leave the child in the car, excuse me. Blount, the defendant here, gets out of the car, he initially refuses to do so. He turns his body away from the officer. He won't get out of the car. He keeps his hand behind his back so that the officer's view is obstructed. But it's apparent to the officer, and the officer articulates in this case, that he's handing items over to the woman, including a black grocery-like plastic bag, and says, and he's saying, come on, come on. Officer says, no, man, get out of the car, get out of the car. He can see that here Blount is tucking something underneath the passenger seat, but he can't see what it is. And he can tell with this, he's very uneasy, and he can tell he's very nervous. The officer's like, there's something bad here. He's hiding something. Man, get out of the car, get out of the car. He gets Blount out of the car, and he says, hey, can I just leave? No. Put your hands behind your back. I'm going to pat you down. He puts him in handcuffs. He pats him down. He can see inside the car, though, that the woman is still moving around a lot. She's holding a large amount of cash. He says, man, put the money down. Stop. Keep your hands on the steering wheel. But again, she's moving around a lot, like she's, shifting stuff or something. And so he begins to frisk the vehicle for weapons. And he looks through that plastic bag that he thought, the bag he thinks that it was that he had handed to the woman. Can't find anything in it. He said, well, it's got to be some, what is it that he was trying to hide? So he looks in a green diaper bag that he had seen her pull up. Again, he didn't find anything. And then he searches the console area and finds a handgun tucked underneath the passenger seat. And remember, we saw Blount reaching under like he was tucking something underneath the passenger seat. At that point, then he detains Blount, finds out he's a convicted felon, and he finds some crack cocaine in the vehicle, and he gets charged with possession of a firearm by a felon. So here, right, we have more than just the single furtive gesture, right? We've got more than that. But again, the question is going to be, did the officer lawfully find the firearm? So just like in all these other cases, we're going to sort of ask two questions, right? First is, does he lawfully detain Blount? And second of all, does he lawfully pat him down, right? And we've talked about a couple of cases today. And so, you know, we talked about a case, for example, the case Kummel versus Hendrick. That's the traffic stop where the officers exceed the scope of the pat down. And in that case, the court said the traffic stop made it lawful to stop Mr. Hendrick. They didn't have lawful reason to pat him down based on a single furtive gesture. When they got more information, maybe that did give them the authority to pat him down, but they exceeded the scope of that pat down. In Blount, in Peters, which is the trespassing case in Creighton Court, the court says you really didn't have any reason to stop him in the first place, much less pat him down. So they didn't even get into the whole pat down issue. They said you shouldn't have detained him in the first place. Here, the court says, yeah, you clearly had the authority here to seize him. But when did you actually seize him, right? Well, the question is, you only really seize him when you respond to the fight, you hear the scream, you run, you call for backup, you show up, you see this crying child, you see the people in the car, they give explanations. The explanations sound like phony explanations. The officer here articulates very effectively, I think, victims of domestic violence may be unwilling to report abuse, especially in front of their abuser. So I have a reason to think that she's not telling me the truth. And then when I order him to get out of the car, he doesn't comply. He instead turns his body away so the officer can't see what he's doing and starts handing items over to the woman and looks like he's tucking something under the car. And that's the point when Blount gets seized, right? Because Blount doesn't agree to step out of the car. They're just having a conversation. The officer's just having a conversation with people in the car. The first time that Blount gets seized is when he actually complies and steps out of the car. And at that point, that's when the seizure takes place, right? Because a seizure has to be the show of authority plus compliance. And he doesn't comply until he gets out of the car. That's when he gets seized. And with all those totality of the circumstances, of course there's enough to believe that Blount is engaged in some kind of criminal activity. But now the next question is, do we think that that criminal activity also involves the potential for weapons, that he might be armed? And the court here says, well, you know, Terry is about a forced police encounter, a situation where a suspect is reasonably believed to possess a weapon, and therefore a danger exists justifying a protective sweep. Again, you have this scream, you get there, the officer expresses the reasons why he's concerned for his own safety, that he sees them exchanging items, appears to be some kind of violence, they're hiding something from him. And so the court here says, yeah, absolutely, the officer had reasonable suspicion to justify a frisk and a search of the vehicle for weapons based on the totality of circumstances. And again, notice here that just like Hendrick, so Hendrick has that one single furtive gesture. Here we've got much more furtive gestures right here in front of the officer where they're sticking objects, hiding objects while looking right at the officer. And again, that's a lot more like that Hill case I was telling you about where the officers come up on the guy and he's looking straight at the officers and immediately starts like looking underneath the seat like he's trying to hide something. Here, that's exactly what we have in this case is he orders him to step out of the car and instead of stepping out of the car, he immediately turns his body away and starts handing her items and sticking something underneath the car. But are we in the trouble with Hendrick? What about the scope of the frisk? Did the officer, by opening up all these different bags in the car, go outside the scope of the frisk? Was he looking for more than just weapons? Because, you know, he looks into a diaper bag. He looks in the zippered pockets of a diaper bag, even though those were very small zippers. He looks inside the grocery bag, even though the grocery bag was very light and didn't appear to have a weapon in it. But here, the court here says, no, you know, those are items that clearly Blount is handing to this woman. He clearly is trying to hide something in these items. And it would be lawful to look in those places, but ultimately it doesn't really matter because there's no weapons found in those. And the court here says, where can he definitely look? The console area, the door compartment, the area underneath the passenger seat where the guy is reaching, and the officer does look in those places. He looks in the console area. He looks in the door compartment. He looks underneath the passenger seat. And clearly a pat down would allow him to do that. He did look there, and that's where he finds the gun. So, you know, well, why does the court in this case say you looked in a bag that was clearly too light, it was full of trash to have a weapon, but that doesn't mean you exceeded the scope of the frisk, whereas in Hendrick you looked in places where you could find a weapon and that did exceed the scope of the frisk. And remember, what was so important in Hendrick was, in Hendrick, once they found the drugs, they stopped looking. Whereas in this case, when the officer's looking through like this little bag of trash that was too light to have a weapon in it, he puts that bag away and keeps looking until he finds weapons. And then when he finds weapons, right, that's when he stops, when he's secured, he's looked inside the console area, he looked in the door compartment, he looks underneath the passenger seat, and then when he's satisfied he's found any weapons in the car, that's when the search stops. So what are the lessons? What are the takeaways from this, right? Well, the number one takeaway, and we've talked about this before many times, is if you have the lawful authority for a Terry stop, for a pat down, finish the pat down, right? Don't just give up once you find something, especially drugs, right? Because the person may still very well be armed. That was the whole point of you doing the pat down in the first place. And the fact that you found drugs is just more indication that the person probably has gotten a weapon on them. So, you know, again, finish your pat downs. Hendrick, they really hurt themselves by not finishing that pat down. In addition, be careful of, you know, of getting ahead of yourself and looking for contraband. In Hendrick, they're talking about finding contraband openly instead of looking for weapons, which is what they had the authority to do. And, you know, clearly in that case, if they had just confined their pat down to weapons, they would have found the drugs and it would have been admissible, but they decided to go on a drug search anyway. And we've seen other cases like that before. And then, you know, in Peters, which is a case from the city of Richmond, you know, that case, a lot of that was about articulation and about the concern that here they say the reason for the stop is trespassing, but they let the other trespasser go. They have all this information about him being a drug dealer, but they don't in any way corroborate it or articulate it as the reason for the stop. And they themselves say, we didn't stop him for that reason. So they really hurt themselves in that case in a lot of ways by letting the other trespasser go and by not articulating the reason for their basis for believing that he's selling drugs in an effective way in court. So three interesting cases. Hopefully they're interesting to you. Hopefully they give you some good tips for the future and you'll learn something today. So that's all from me for today. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. Sorry for the delay. We will try to do them these episodes more often. I just get really, 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 really busy. But for today, that's all from me. That's all for Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured.